NHPR's The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire, your university system. Imagine what you can accomplish here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The federal government expanded unemployment benefits until September for job loss due to COVID-19. But about 20 states, including New Hampshire, have decided to end this in June. At the same time, New Hampshire has resumed its requirement that all qualified individuals demonstrate they are seeking and accepting jobs that are deemed suitable. But some Granite Staters report this is easier said than done, that they struggle to find childcare or have health concerns that make it unsafe to return to the workplace. This hour, we're digging into all this with Rich Lavers. He's the Deputy Commissioner at New Hampshire Employment Security. And Exchange listeners, as always, we welcome your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 800-892-6477. And Deputy Commissioner Lavers, welcome back. We always appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks, Laura. It's great to be back. And thank you for the opportunity to talk with your listeners as well.
So let's just clarify a few things, because I think there's been some confusion. What's changing on June 19th, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, and what isn't changing?
Yeah, I'm glad you started with that question, Laura, because we can, with so many new programs that have been created during the pandemic, we can get lost in this alphabet soup of all of these different unemployment programs. So to recap what is going away on the 19th and what stays for programs here in New Hampshire. So the federal programs that have provided additional benefits, that have provided expanded eligibility, and have extended the number of weeks people can file, those programs are going away as of the week ending June 19th. So the $300, which is known as the FPUC program, the Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation Program, that is one of those that goes away on the 19th, that $300 that people had added to their base benefit. That is also the program that was paying $600 early on in the pandemic. Then we also have the expanded eligibility program, the PUA program, Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. That was a CARES Act program created back in March of 2020. New Hampshire had actually expanded eligibility through an emergency order that Governor Sununu had issued prior to that. And then we participated in the PUA program. So that provides benefits to self-employed individuals filing or unable to conduct their business and needing assistance from unemployment. Folks that had a pandemic reason for not being able to work, those folks were in that program. And then we also had the extended benefit program, or PEUC, Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation. There, I got all three of those acronyms right. So that's an achievement so far today. But that's the program that's paid benefits beyond the 26 weeks that state unemployment usually covers. And then that leaves us with the regular state unemployment program. So people that find themselves unemployed through no fault of their own, as we like to describe it. But what you normally see there are folks that are in a temporary or permanent layoff would be able to access the regular unemployment program. That is going nowhere. That stays right here. It stays available to folks that need that program going forward. 26 weeks of benefits. And right now we have just under 16,000 people that are utilizing that program. And those numbers have really been falling quite dramatically over the past month and a half.
Why did New Hampshire decide to rescind the $300 additional benefits 3 months before the federal government said that the states had to? As I understand, about 20 states, including New Hampshire, have decided to pull this back in June. The Fed said you could go till September.
Yeah, so, you know, it's over 20 states that have made that decision to end participation in that program. New Hampshire paid out, just in that program alone, there was about $1 billion, so with a B, in additional benefits that went out to folks over the course of this pandemic. So a significant source of economic activity in the state, with those people receiving that, spending that locally. But where we find ourselves now is much different than early on, when we really needed the additional benefits to get people closer to that 100% of what they were earning back when they were working. You know, our vaccination rates are really the envy of the rest of the country, where we're getting close to about 70% of our age eligible population has initiated the vaccination process. So the amount of COVID in our communities is significantly down. Listening to Dr. Chan and Dr. Daly, those numbers have really been coming down over the course of the last month. So the situation with the pandemic is different. And then on the workforce side, which is where I spend my time, the historic opportunity that presents itself right now with being such a job seeker dominated market. You know, in the virtual job fairs that we've been putting on throughout the pandemic, Laura, we've had some of these events have been very poorly attended, where you'd have, you know, maybe as many job seekers as we had employers. But over the course of the 23 events that we've hosted during the pandemic, the employers that have participated have been looking to fill close to 45,000 jobs. Now, there's some redundancy in there, obviously, with employers that continue to participate. But when you look at the number of jobs and then only 4,000 job seekers having participated in those events, and then you just have to walk down the street in any town throughout the state to see what employers are willing to offer right now to incentivize people to come in, it's really an opportunity that we don't want people to miss out on. And as I've said to people before, you know, you don't want to kick yourself 6 months from now when you realize the opportunities that were out there that you didn't take advantage of. So getting out there, talking with employers, looking to see what their opportunities are, seeing what kind of flexibilities those employers are willing to offer right now, because again, it's very much a job seeker driven market. I think the state of COVID that we have together with those opportunities that are out there really are the drivers here on why New Hampshire is ending participation in that program prior to some of our surrounding states and prior to what the federal government has authorized it to go into.
Deputy Commissioner Lavers, we've heard from so many listeners about this, the changes, and people are upset and nervous. And I want to play a little audio from a call we got last week from a listener. This is Michael in Somersworth. He's a single dad, and, you know, he's quite concerned about both the ending of the extra $300 and the work requirement, which the work search requirement, which kicked in a couple weeks ago. So let's hear from Michael.
I'm a single father. I have two young kids. One is special needs. Last year when school shut down, I struggled. I was taking my kids to work to try and, you know, keep things smooth. When they weren't going back to school, I was forced to leave my job. So I left a very high-paying job, significantly more than I make on unemployment, even with the federal money. And now I have to face, you know, in a few weeks that I'm going to lose that. You know, I'm in a situation where my kids, I don't have a summer camp I can put them in. You know, and I think there's a lot of people like me. There's plenty of jobs in my field where I could actually go back to work. The problem is finding childcare. And I just feel like the governor's really doing us a disservice by assuming that we're just sitting at home collecting money and not wanting to work. You know, my particular situation, I don't have much of a choice. I mean, I'm just going to have to struggle until they get back into school. There's nothing else I can do. You know, with schools going back opening, you know, I'm hoping that the before and after care programs will be back open as well, you know, which is obviously, you know, a big help for people like me who are single and, you know, work regular jobs. So, you know, unfortunately, I'm going to have to go a few months of struggling and going back to not paying my bills and getting behind on my mortgage and everything else.
So that's a call we received last week on the show. And I have so many emails from other parents as well. I'll share just a few more. Samantha says, why are working parents and caregivers being forced to seek jobs within 30 days notice, or they are shut off from benefits when they can't work normal schedules anymore? The excuse of do what you did before COVID isn't valid, Samantha says. Before and after school centers are closed. Daycares have closed their doors permanently. Summer camps are full within an hour of registration. Samantha says it's going to take more than 30 days to find a job that is flexible and willing to work around working parents and caregivers' schedules. And I just wonder about that, Deputy Commissioner Lavers. You know, for parents of little kids, it's not as easy as, you know, just go back to work.
Yeah, it's always a tough decision to make, right? If you're either, you know, you're working parent versus at staying home to try to provide more care for your children, that's a tough decision either way. I do feel, you know, as we've talked about, the enhancements that employers are providing right now with the additional sign-on bonuses and other incentives, financial incentives, the incentives they're putting out there aren't limited to just financial, right? So there's a lot that employers are doing around flexibility with schedules. I can speak from my own direct experience here with an agency that employs about 300 people. You know, we've been flexible with our workers that have kids that are remote learning or continue to need to remote learn. You know, we've been flexible with our employees that have underlying medical conditions. And I think a lot of employers find themselves in that same situation. So it's not as one as I think it was the email that you had read, Laura. It's not just simply go back to what you did prior to COVID. The situation now is much different than prior to COVID. The number of job opportunities that are out there, the amount of remote work that seems to be here to stay and a much larger percentage than it was prior to the pandemic, and those flexibilities that employers are willing to offer right now in order to attract those workers because they have to. They're competing against one another to attract the workforce that they need in order to be able to conduct their business. And again, I think people will be very surprised once they go out there and look and start asking those questions with what types of positions are available. And you know, the work search requirement, it's not a work requirement, as you pointed out. It's a work search requirement, right? We're expecting that you will meet some minimum requirements for contacting hiring employers in your field or in a field that you're looking to get into. And it's not a big ask right now. It's the minimum. You know, for someone to maintain eligibility right now, they need to contact two hiring employers. Or if they can't do that, they need to engage in five activities during a week that obviously, as you check some of those off, you're going to have fewer activities to be able to participate in. But, you know, working on your resume, working on your list of resources, participating in some of our programs and services that we have over here. So it's not a big lift to meet that work search requirement. And it's a minimum. It should be viewed not as what do I need to do to meet the work search requirement. It really should be viewed as what do I need to do to get a job.
So what are those activities, those five activities? I think you were starting to list them, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, that people have to present to say that they're filling the work requirement.
Yeah, so we have folks that filed starting this past Sunday have seen the list of activities. It's a couple of pages long on their weekly claim. What we did prior to the work search requirement coming back online was we held about 60 virtual sessions or workshops for filers. We invited everybody to a workshop so that they could actually hear from department staff on the work search requirement, how you go about satisfying it, what the screens look like, the types of activities, the programs that we have to assist them with those activities. And then we put a link to that video up on our website and actually sent it out directly to all of the active claim filers so they could all see it ahead of this first week, last week, that we had the work search requirement back in play. So it's, you know, for people that were in traditional employment, it's working on their resume. It's working on their list of contacts. It's looking at different hiring sites. So certainly we would encourage people to utilize those that the department maintains with our, you know, we have our various job boards and our recruitment portals and our virtual job fairs, but people can use private sites as well. They can go to job fairs that are put on by other organizations and other employers. They can utilize some of our own resources that we have for people, such as our materials that we use to actually help people get themselves ready to start searching for work, with helping them understand how you go about searching right now, how you go about updating your resume. So there's a lot of activities that are that people are able to utilize in addition to making contacts with hiring employers whom, you know, for which we provide lists of hiring employers across all sectors for people to consider. So it's like I said before, that minimum requirement isn't a big lift once you actually look into it. And we've tried to make the information available to everybody and make it easily accessible so everyone understands that work search requirement.
Well, I have a very specific question about that from a listener, Erica, who says, if someone was scheduled to attend the job fair that was canceled, will that still count as this week's fulfillment? Most planned on that counting for this week's work search, and now it's not till the end of the month. Shelley also wanted to know if there was going to be a replacement job fair this week, since the one scheduled for Wednesday was moved. So what about the job fairs? It sounds like that does satisfy the work requirement, but if it gets canceled, what is somebody supposed to do?
Yeah, so those are good questions, Bob. So for last Wednesday's event, we did have to reschedule that because of some technical issues with the vendor who supports that platform. The good news for Shelley is that it is being rescheduled, and we are actually re-registering all of those job seekers that were registered for that event. So they'll be hearing from us again. They're probably sick of hearing from us, where we first contacted them to let them know what happened. We apologized. We then reached back out to them, let them know that we're going to schedule the event, and we'll re-register for them for that event. And we'll be getting that information out to them. But more importantly, for those folks that, as you had indicated, were counting on attending that virtual job fair in order to satisfy their work search requirement.
Right.
I really think they're looking at it in the wrong way. You know, attending a virtual job fair, and we've tried to encourage more people to do that. Really, the reason why we've been encouraging that is because it's kind of, you know, you've got, in many cases, over 100 hiring employers all in one place, right? It's like shooting fish in a barrel. Every single one of them are hiring across all sectors. We've had every region of the state at each of these events. So it's a great event to go and to actively participate, not something where you need to go log on to the platform and then find the employment security table to find out what you need to do to make sure that we know you were there. It's really something where you need to be actively participating, take advantage of the opportunity that New Hampshire is providing, which many states, I would say most states, are not doing anything like this with these virtual job fair events. But even if you are unable to get on the platform on Wednesday because of the high demand and so many people coming on, we provided a 52-page document to each registered job seeker prior to the event, listing every employer that was registered, a description of each job that they were recruiting for, and the contact information for each of the hiring managers. So what a great resource to be able to use after that job fair, or if you were unable to get on the platform, what a great resource to be able to use to find out what's available near you in the sector that you're looking to not only satisfy the work search requirement, but to really actively engage with these employers and see what's available.
So to Erica's question though, so, you know, she's specifically saying, okay, that she was hoping that would still count towards that week's fulfillment, but it was canceled. So does it still count? Is she supposed to sort of engage with the, yeah, go ahead.
She would need to, again, and the, you know, the events themselves satisfying that work search requirement, it's not about just logging on to the event and then being able to check off that box and not have to worry about work search until the following week. It was to try to encourage active participation because you have so many hiring employers in one space. So if you were unable to get on for that event, everything else that you have available to you to satisfy that minimum requirement for your work search is still available to you. You have that 52-page document of hiring employers. You have our recruitment portals. So everything is still available to you. It might not be as convenient as having been able to go on the platform, but it's still pretty close to being as convenient with the resources that we make available to everyone that was registered.
All right, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, hard to believe we have to take a very quick station break. When we come back, I've got a lot more questions from listeners, including those who have health concerns and are concerned about going back into the workplace with COVID still circulating, albeit at a much lower level. And we'll talk a little bit more about those virtual job fairs that you mentioned. A lot more of your questions too. So listeners, join us at 800-892-6477 or by email exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, major changes in the state's unemployment insurance system. We're talking with the Deputy Commissioner of New Hampshire Employment Security, Rich Lavers. And listeners, let's hear from you. If you have questions about how the system works, comments, personal experiences, send us your thoughts by email to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 800-892-6477. So Deputy Commissioner Lavers, before the break, we were talking about the renewal or the return of the work search requirement that was taken away during the pandemic, was put back in place in late May. A more technical question about that. We heard from many, many listeners recently who tried to submit the work search requirement while they were applying for continuing their unemployment. And they didn't have the option to prove their work search requirement on the website. So lots of people said, am I going to lose my unemployment benefits for not proving that, even though the website didn't give me the option to prove it? We've had dozens of inquiries about this.
Yeah, so the good news for those folks that, those were folks that filed early on Sunday in most cases. There's, as they've probably already experienced today with the direct deposit for the benefits from last week being put into their bank account today, that did not have any impact on their claim from last week. So there were some filers early on who didn't see the work search screens due to a technical oversight on the part of the department, mostly people that had been filing since the early part of the pandemic, where early on when we were implementing a lot of changes, we had put in a waiver for some of those initial filers to make sure that they didn't have problems back in March and April of 2020 because of a work search issue holding up payment when we weren't requiring it. And in some cases, that waiver that had been put on their claim back in March of 2020 didn't get removed. So we've since corrected it. We didn't want to do anything on Sunday to correct it that would disrupt claim filing or cause confusion or just cause anxiety to build amongst those people who are depending on those benefits. So we made sure not to do anything on Sunday to impact those benefits. It's good that they completed the activities or contacts that they needed to do during the week for eligibility. And then when they go in, they file their next claim, they're going to be presented with the screens that they thought they were going to see on Sunday. And again, that was a few of our a lower percentage of the filers Sunday that it impacted, but they'll see those screens next week.
So another question about the work requirement. It requires that anybody receiving unemployment insurance must demonstrate they are searching for work and that they're not turning down what's called, quote, suitable work. Again, this is a return to prior policy. How do you, though, define suitable work? We've gotten questions from listeners about this who say, look, I can't, you know, someone said this just last week on the show, I can't support my family on what he called a Duncan's job. So how do you guys define what's suitable and what isn't?
Yeah, so it's a great question and one that we do go through pretty extensively in the workshops that we made available to everyone prior to implementing the work search requirement. But it's exactly that. It's not that you have to accept any and every job. It's that you need to accept that which would be considered suitable. Suitable, we look at not only what you were doing before and what sector you're looking to either stay in or get into. So what are the wages being paid in that sector, what you were earning before. Someone that was making over $20 an hour and now is looking at a job where they're making $10 an hour, you know, that's not going to be considered suitable employment that they would be required to take. We'd want to work with that person to show them the other opportunities that are out there, but they wouldn't be required to take that job. So we look at the geographic location of the job that's being offered to you. We look at other situations going on at home for the individual. All of that is all wrapped up in our statute and rule that talk about suitable work. So we look at that. And at the end of the day, Laura, I know that people think that for every job refusal that's reported by an employer, that results in someone losing benefits. That's simply not the case. There's only about 10% of these job refusals that get reported to us that result in the person losing eligibility because the position was determined to be suitable. So it really comes down to, you know, what you were doing before, what you were earning before, and where you are located. And we look at all of that to make sure that, again, the person that you just described that was in a different sector making higher wages wasn't forced to go take something just in order to satisfy the work search requirement.
We got a lot of emails too, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, from people who do have health concerns. Again, the pandemic is moving in the right direction, but you know, people are still coming down with COVID. And I want to share two of these. These people are worried to go back to work because of their health concerns. Esmeralda says, what is expected of those out of work under a doctor's quarantine? The federal bill passed states that claiming due to be high risk is a legitimate reason. What should these claimants be doing for work search? Some of them, myself included, have disabled children who are too young to receive a COVID vaccination. And the whole household is under doctor's orders to steer clear of the public. Similar email from Jessica, who says 3/4 of my family are at high risk, being forced against doctor's orders to return to work when doing so could potentially kill myself, my husband, and my 12-year-old, leaving my 16-year-old orphaned. My 12-year-old has an unknown allergy that almost killed her once, so she can't get the vaccine. Jessica says, you know, New Hampshire politicians are being selfish. They need to put people first. What about people who really do not feel safe going back into any kind of a public workplace? Is that a suitable concern to turn down so-called suitable work?
Yeah, so some tough situations there that you described. For the most part, when you look at the folks that have been utilizing or are still utilizing that federal expansion program, it's largely the self-employed that are continuing to utilize that right now, so not really falling into that group. But there are still some filers, as you've heard from Laura, that do find themselves in those difficult situations. So for the caller that actually had still sounded like they still had a relationship with their prior employer and had an opportunity to go back, I think having that conversation with the employer about what they are currently providing in terms of accommodations and flexibilities, I think that's if they haven't already had that conversation, they need to. See what they are currently requiring, see what they currently have within the work environment, how much is remote, what type of scheduling flexibilities can be provided. I think those conversations are important. And then if that's not an option with the employer that the person was last with, then having those conversations with all of the employers that we're providing access to through our hiring events and our hiring portals about what they're currently doing around remote work options, flexibility in terms of schedules. So I think that's the real difference right now. You asked about that earlier with the difference between pre-pandemic and post-pandemic. And that's really it. I think that you're more likely to be able to find employers more willing to engage in conversation around those flexibilities and around some of those accommodations. You know, we do it right here with you know, my direct experience here with an agency with about 300 people. So, and I know what's going on out there with our private sector employers as well.
Here's an email from Jennifer, who's self-employed. Jennifer says, job search requirements should be waived for self-employed individuals and replaced with business building activities. Is there anything in the works that will address the unique needs of self-employed individuals? Jennifer, I'm glad you wrote because, you know, New Hampshire has a lot of sort of solo entrepreneurs and self-employed folks. So go ahead, Deputy Commissioner Leavers.
Yeah, so she brings up a good point. And the self-employed, for those that want to stay in self-employment, the way they would go about a satisfying the work search requirement is much different than someone in traditional W-2 employment. And that's why we made changes to our work search screens and our work search requirement. So I would encourage her to go on our website, either go to unemploymentbenefits.nh.gov or nhes.nh.gov, click on the top link that is a video to our work search requirement workshop. It actually shows the screens that highlight what a self-employed individual can attest to as to having engaged in those types of activities. So we have specific activities for the self-employed, and a lot of the activities that you can use to satisfy the work search, really they cross over between W-2 employment and self-employment. But we know that's not always the case. That's why we have a specific section on the work search requirement page dealing specifically with self-employed.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. And again, we welcome your questions and comments this hour at 800-892-6477 or by email exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org. Here's another one from Kate, who says, why, as a high-risk person, was I denied and still waiting since November for an appeal when you have all my doctor's documents? This has destroyed my credit completely, among other things. Let's talk about the appeals process. I know that this is a big deal for folks. How quickly are you supposed to process appeals, Deputy Commissioner Leavers? November seems like a long time ago when you're waiting for benefits.
Yeah, so, I mean, first, I'd want to make sure we get that information from that listener, Laura, so that we can look, have the people here at the department look to see what's going on with that claim. So appeals are a very important part of the unemployment process, right? Folks that disagree with a determination either on their initial eligibility or disagree with a determination that might stop benefits after they had been collecting, for maybe it was a refusal of a suitable offer of work. But those folks have the opportunity to file an appeal. They have the opportunity to go up through multiple levels of appeal all the way up to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Right now with our appeals unit, prior to the pandemic, we were doing about 200 hearings per month, Laura. Right now we're doing 800.
Oh,
so
wow,
we're trying,
that's a lot.
So we're So we're doing our best to keep up with that increased demand for people that have that are appealing denials that had stopped their benefits. So we've brought on more staff. We continue to bring on more staff. We've actually started the process of bringing on private sector New Hampshire-based law firms to conduct some of these hearings. We have some some firms that we're already working with, others that we're going to be bringing on board to try to increase our capacity. Because I'd like to get up to 1,200 hearings per month. I look back at the Great Recession to see how we did in terms of how quickly we were able to get through that backlog of appeals hearings. And you know, people had to wait quite a long time in many situations, close to and over a year to have their cases heard.
Oh, wow.
Heard.
So what are they supposed to do in the meantime? That's really stressful.
Well, that, yeah. So that's, you know, that was the experience back in the Great Recession. And what we're, our goal here right now is to have all of this wrapped up, all of these pandemic related appeals heard by the fall of this year. So we're really increasing that capacity to get those appeals heard as quickly as we can. It's a tough area in which to ramp up overnight. As you can imagine, the person that sits there and hears an appeal case, they require quite a bit of knowledge and expertise, not only on how to conduct an appeal hearing, but they have to know all of these programs that we talked about at the beginning of your show and all of the unique eligibility criteria for each. So we have some great people that do those hearings. We've more than doubled our capacity there with the number of hearings officers. You saw that with the numbers that I quoted and our continued improvement that we're going to see in that area with the law firms that we're bringing in to try to hear these cases faster. You know, what we do see in a lot of these cases, though, people disagree with the underlying determination, but we have to remember that the unemployment program is an eligibility-based program. So the fact that someone needs the benefits isn't the determining factor. It's, does the person qualify? Do they meet the eligibility criteria that are either defined by the feds or defined by the state as meeting the, those requirements for receiving those benefits? Many of those cases, someone can be in a very difficult situation, but they don't have the underlying eligibility for meeting that. They didn't previously work, or they might have worked, but it had been maybe 6 months prior to the pandemic. And so it wasn't the pandemic that caused them to be out of work. So there's a lot that goes into each of those situations, and many of them can be like quite difficult for the individual.
So they take a long time. Yeah, I just have a question. Is there a legal requirement for processing these appeals in a timely way? Because as you said, you know, people are often in dire straits when they're in one of these appeals processes. So does the law say you guys have to have it done within a month or 6 months or?
You know, prior to the pandemic, we were scheduling our appeals within the 14 days of receipt. We had, you know, we were hearing over 90% of these within the month, meeting all of our federal benchmarks. Obviously, with the volume resulting from the pandemic, with 170,000 people having received benefits over the course of the year, which equaled our total claimant population for the prior decade, that changes the ability to be able to hear those appeals as quickly. What we're required to do by the federal government is that we are required to hear the cases as quickly as we can under the circumstances that we find ourselves. So I think New Hampshire, as well as other states, are in a tough spot with trying to hear those cases as quickly as the public would like. We're doing as much as we can and beyond, I think, what other states are doing in terms of trying to hear them quicker than we did during the Great Recession, despite having a small percentage of the claims that we've had during the pandemic. So we're doing some out of the box thinking here, bringing in outside law firms to try to expedite the hearing of these cases.
Said, yeah. Has the legislature given you the resources to bring in those private contractors or more staff to hear these cases in a timely way?
Yeah, so when we talk about funding for this department, Laura, we're really a federal funded agency. All of our funding from the federal government is for the unemployment program or the reemployment program. And then employers in the state pay a portion of their quarterly unemployment taxes that support the department as well. So we have no general funding from the state, and the amount of increased funding that we've received from the federal government because of the increase in claims, what they refer to as above base funding, has been certainly sufficient for us to bring in the additional resources, which we have done, some with our own direct hires, others with bringing in vendors to help supplement some of those services. You know, you look at the hotline that we have available right now, that is vendor supported. Initially, early on, that was supported by the National Guard. And so we've used these additional resources that have been made available to bring in staff, bring in vendors to try to increase our capacity in a way that we can handle what will hopefully be a short-term increase in activity in each of those areas.
All right, we're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, a lot more of your questions and comments for Rich Lavers, again, Deputy Commissioner of New Hampshire Employment Security. Join us with your comments and questions about unemployment insurance here in the state. And stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, almost 50 years since the federal civil rights law known as Title IX, we ask what inequity looks like in women's sports today. Join us for that conversation Thursday morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking about changes in New Hampshire's unemployment insurance system with Rich Lavers. He's the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment Security. And Exchange listeners, it's been great to get all of your comments. Join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 800-892-6477. And Deputy Commissioner Lavers, another point of clarification that I'd like to just get on the table with you, because we've heard from a lot of listeners, has to do with this issue of overpayments. This was something that came up earlier this year. People concerned that if they were overpaid, they would either have to pay it back, or they would have to pay interest on it or taxes on it, or go through a lengthy appeals process to deal with that. What is the status of people who were accidentally overpaid earlier in the pandemic?
Yeah, so we have, you can kind of separate those types of situations into two buckets, Laura. You have those where the individual who was filing is considered to be at fault because they provided us information which was later determined to be inaccurate and they shouldn't have received those benefits. So we have those folks, that's about $18 million worth of overpaid benefits, largely from the federal programs. About 1% of the total benefits paid out. Remember, we've paid almost $1.9 billion. So about 1% of that was paid to folks that shouldn't have received it because they provided us information that was inaccurate, maybe about when they last worked, why they weren't working, things of that nature. Then we also have those where people that were paid benefits that weren't eligible, but it wasn't anything that they did wrong. It was the department either not acting appropriately on the information we had or simply putting them in the wrong program that they didn't have eligibility for because of the confusion in the first portion of the pandemic with changing guidance from the federal government, or in many cases, no guidance at all. So when you look at those two buckets, what people are informed when they receive that determination, they're instructed on how they can go about filing an appeal. They are also instructed on how they can go about requesting a waiver or forgiveness of that overpayment. With state unemployment benefits that are overpaid. We can make that decision right then and there, Laura. If someone is not at fault, we forgive them of their overpayment, and it's right there in that determination. Unfortunately, with overpayments from the federal programs, we can't do that. So we largely have to look at those one-on-one individually to determine whether or not the individual meets the federal standards for forgiveness. So folks,
that takes
are
some time, I'm guessing.
It does. It takes a lot of resources. What we have done and provided that information to people is that they have the knowledge on how to go about requesting a waiver. That information is right up on our website with the form that they need to use. We need them to fill out a financial affidavit. That's required by the federal process. And then we look at it, see if they were at fault in the creation of the overpayment. And then if not, those folks will be forgiven of those overpayments. But again, it's going to be largely on an individual basis. There is some opportunity to do blanket waivers, but they've really limited the types of groups that will qualify for those blanket waivers. So I don't
the
think
federal
it's going
government.
To have, the, yeah, the federal government. I don't think it's going to have much impact here in New Hampshire, and we're going to be largely needing to look at all of those individually, which we're doing right now, and we have been for several months once we got the guidance from the federal government on what they wanted the states to do in terms of implementing their standard.
How long does it take people typically to get an answer on this overpayment issue? And do they lose benefits while they're waiting for that answer?
Well, you got to remember, with a lot of these people that have a waiver pending, it's not that they're appealing their denial, they're requesting forgiveness of benefits that they shouldn't have been paid, right? So they've been paid more benefits than they were eligible for. And what they receive from us is right after they get the information from us on how to go about requesting a waiver, when they file that waiver, they receive an acknowledgement letting them know that we've received it. We're going to review to make sure we have all of the information that we need. And then we'll be reaching back out to them either to get some missing information or to provide them with a determination. We'd like to be doing those faster than we are right now, but we're trying to stay in contact with those individuals. They know that when they submit that request either for an appeal or for a waiver, right now there aren't any collection efforts that are being taken against that debt. That was something that New Hampshire was already doing with regard to people that had requested a waiver. The federal government came out with guidance, I think last week or the week prior, where states cannot collect those debts while someone has a waiver request pending. So we don't do any of that. So, you know, it's longer than people would like to wait for a decision on those waivers. But largely that's driven by the fact that states have to deal with it in a very inefficient way individually because of the federal requirement. We'd like to deal with them faster in a more blanket fashion. We're not allowed to, but the good news for that individual is that there's no interest accruing on that debt. There's no collection efforts being undertaken with regard to that debt, but they do have to wait longer than I'm sure most of them would like. But at the end of the day, if they're not at fault in creating that overpayment, Laura, they're not going to be responsible for paying anything back to the state.
I got a bunch of emails from people who, you know, worry about the timing of the loss of the $300 federal additional benefit. Again, the federal government said this was going to expire in September. New Hampshire and a bunch of other states said we're going to pull it back in June. And I heard from a lot of people, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, who seem to be saying, look, you know, the summer is kind of a dicey time. You know, there's not a lot of childcare. People who work for the school system are kind of waiting for their jobs to come back. I just want to share a couple of these emails with you, please. Mona in Stratum says, I'm an early childhood educator returning to my school August 25th. Can I expect to continue to apply for unemployment compensation until then? Tiff says he's curious why there needs to be a job search for people returning to their furloughed jobs later in the summer, early fall. Could those collecting unemployment just submit documentation from their employer stating their return to work date. And then Hazel is a school bus driver. Hazel says, what is a 65-year-old with a job she's had for 38 years supposed to do, who's on a leave of absence with a doctor's note? How is she supposed to do a job search? It's a school bus driver job that ends in late June and with a guaranteed return at the end of August. So does she want the department to, does the department want her to have return for 2 to 3 weeks against a doctor's recommendation, then laid off at the end of school? Why take away the $300 that the federal government has already approved? I don't get it. So these are all individual questions, but there's all just kind of this broader theme of, could you guys have waited until September when childcare is going to be more settled? People who work for the school system, you know, part-time or whatever, will be back at work. People are just concerned that the timing of this isn't good, that you should have waited until September.
Yeah, a couple of different issues there, right, to unpackage. So with people that a lot of those folks that you described there, Laura, have situations that aren't any different than any other summer, right? So your school employees or your school bus drivers particularly, those folks are, in some cases, are worried about the work search requirement over the summer. Once they take the time to look at the information we have on our website and watch the workshop that we made available to them, they'll understand and realize that for folks that have a definite date for return to work, bus drivers fall into this. As long as it's within 11 weeks, they don't need to search for work during that summer break. That return to work needs to be within 11 weeks. And this was a change the legislature made just in the past 2 years with bus drivers in mind, looking at the fact that there was at the time a bus driver shortage in the state. We didn't want to be doing anything to encourage them to find other employment outside of that industry. And so individuals who had a definite date for return to work within 11 weeks are not required to search for work. And one thing I haven't been able to mention, Laura, but it's important, is that folks that have questions, that have questions with work search requirement or with their claim, and they would rather deal with somebody in person rather than the hotline that continues to be available Monday through Friday, our offices are back open.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so our offices, we reopened our offices about 2 weeks ahead of the work search requirement coming back on, again, to give folks that resource to go in, talk to a person about their questions, or use our resource centers that we have there with computers and other tools for people to search for work. So all of our offices are open. We have offices located throughout the state, and we are open right now Monday through Friday, 12 to 4. Staff are available to help folks with those work search related questions. Folks that have eligibility questions, we're still hoping they go to the hotline. That's where the expertise on answering those questions still lies. But work search related issues, folks, they can go into any of the New Hampshire Works offices. Where we have locations as far north as Colebrook, all the way down to Nashua, out in Keene, and on the seacoast in Portsmouth and Somersworth. So we're everywhere here in the state.
Well, last question for you, please. And boy, we've learned over the past year, if we didn't know before, that there's a lot of frustration within how the New Hampshire unemployment system works, even apart from the pandemic. But it's definitely boiled up over the past year with so many folks having their economic situation disrupted. What might be improved with this system moving forward?
Well, we always want to get to a point where you're able to issue decisions as quickly as possible, right? And I think when you look at how New Hampshire did in the early parts of this pandemic and throughout 2020, we surpassed that which we did from the Great Recession. But let's not just compare ourselves to ourselves. Let's compare ourselves to other states. And New Hampshire did better than most other states in terms of getting those dollars out quickly when people really needed it. But I understand there's frustration because when you're out of work, that first payment can't come soon enough. So we can always work to improve our system, bring in better technology to try to make sure people understand the process, make sure they understand who is eligible and who is not, because that was a lot of the frustration, Laura, was people thinking that the unemployment program was for everyone. I see a lot of these comments. I hear from people, it's still an eligibility-based program. We're here for those that are eligible, that had been working, that are unemployed through no fault of their own. So we got to keep that in mind, that it's not just simply a program that pays benefits to everyone that needs it.
Well, Deputy Commissioner Lavers, we really appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Laura. Thanks for the opportunity again. I appreciate it.
That's Rich Lavers, Deputy Commissioner at the New Hampshire Department of Employment Security. Today's show was produced by Exchange Senior Producer Christina Phillips. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.